coming up next on RCR. Speak Free with Simon O'Connor. In a topsy-turvy world, good old-fashioned ideas may seem foreign to some, but still make a lot of sense to many. Join Simon as he speaks with local and international guests to explore the values and perspectives that shape our world. Get your common sense fixed with conversations that celebrate democracy, freedom, and our fundamental rights. It's Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome everyone to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor. It is wonderful to join you again this Friday morning. And what a week, it has been since, of course, last week, my first time here on RCR. And so, look, a big thank you to all of you for the amazing messages that have been sent through. So we have a busy couple of hours ahead of us, and one big part of it actually is me going to engage as best I can with many of those emails, texts, and messages. So I'm wanting to do an extended mailbag this week to, well, as I say, to engage and respond some really, really good questions, including around Parliament and protests and what I was or was not doing there. And obviously lots of feedback on the discussions last week with Joanne Oh from Taiwan and so forth. On that, I might as well jump straight in. If you do have feedback at any time and on the program today, look, drop us an email at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Or, of course, you can also text us at 2057. I love to hear from you, so please do. We do, though, have a very busy couple of hours ahead of us. I've got on Nick Hain from the Free Speech Union. He is working in the education space, so he's going to be talking about involvement with young people, schools around free speech. I'm really looking forward to that discussion. As you know, I'm big into free speech. And my other special guest this morning is going to be Dr. Paul Moon. He's a professor of history at AUT. He's written a book on the Kiwi Dutch photographer, Arns Westra. So we talk about his new book. And I'm also going to talk to him about the importance of history. I thought if I'm going to have him on the show, I might as well extend the interview into that question. You know, why is history important? The other thing I'm going to be touching on is the budget that was released yesterday at 2 o'clock. So I've done a little bit of reading. And so I've got a few comments to make today. I'll probably have to do more the week after. It's always pretty complex, but I thought I'd just touch on a few things there. So again, settle in for the next couple of hours here on Speak Free. Well, I assume the big topic of conversation today is going to be yesterday's budget. So as we all know, this new government gave out its budget yesterday, pretty much as predicted. So I thought I'd just give a few thoughts on that. Look, factor in, as you listen to me, my own, if you will, bias. I mean, I come out of the National Party. I'm a centre-right-leaning conservative. So that obviously shapes my thinking. And what I'm going to try and be as objective as I can here, trying to do that, I think it's important to declare my hand up front. So I'll do my best, but I probably lean more into a budget like this because first and foremost, as the budget indicates, the economy for New Zealand's in really, really troubled times. One of the clearest indicators is we're not expecting to be in surplus or, for want of a better term, a profit. We're not going to start making money again until, I think, 2027, 2028. So obviously, you know, some pretty tough, lean times ahead. A big part of the budget, of course, is all around tax cuts. It was well signalled. It's something which National in particular campaigned on, and so they've delivered that. There'll obviously be people who will want more. There'll be those of us who would argue, hey, could the money be spent elsewhere? But I think it's fair to say that they've delivered what they said they would, and it is relatively meaningful for people. You will see that in your pay packets. But I'll just make a couple of observations. One is that the government politically had to do this. It's something which worries me in general terms and across political parties. When any MP or minister declares they must do something or they'll resign, what it does is lock them in. And this is a classic case here. This was something which the new government promised it would do. And so it had to do it. I mean, obviously, like any you know, any politician, they could have backed down and changed their mind. But in this case, they didn't want to. So in many ways, good. They've said what they're going to do. But on the flip side, there's a whole lot of other choices now that couldn't be made, even if they wanted to do, because actually the tax cuts, it's substantial. It's a substantial tax cut. But the key point being that once you promise you're doing something, then a whole lot of other options disappear. The second is, and I suggest to people, we can be thankful but not grateful for the likes of tax cuts. And you're going, what does he mean by that? Well, just remember, first and foremost, you can be thankful. It's good that more money is coming back into your accounts. But I'm suggesting we don't have to be grateful, because at the end of the day, that money was yours in the first place. Government takes taxes off you. And now they're just returning some of that. So again, thanks. Good to have the money. But never forget, and hence why you don't have to be grateful. It's the government that took it off you in the first place. And similarly, a little bit around the childcare dynamic as well, a lot of money into funding childcare, and that's good. But again, you're encouraged to put your children to childcare so you can work. The government then taxes you and takes that money off you, and then they give it back to you so that, you know, you can look after your children. So it's a sort of a funny loop. So never forget that anything the government gives you came from you in the first place. On the slightly, it's the side of things, it's not so positive. The government's not funding an array of new cancer drugs that it said it would. I'm disappointed by that as someone who's got an interest in healthcare. But as I say, if you lock yourself into the concept of tax cuts, a whole lot of other things don't follow. Other things that I've noted, and by the way, the budget's huge. So I, since 2 o'clock yesterday, have been trying to process through it. Some of the other things, obviously the cuts to Crown funding, those are substantial. Now we'll see more job cuts. As I say, when the government's accounts are so bad, they have to tighten up somewhere. They're moving fees free from the first year to the last year. Personally, I think that makes a lot of sense. Sadly, a lot of people don't actually complete or succeed in their first year. So much better to have the incentive in the last year. I see they want to introduce an online gambling tax. That's a good thing. You know, casinos, physical casinos at the moment, if you will, pay taxes or levies. So it makes sense that the online space should as well. But looking at the numbers, I think the government remains far too optimistic for how much money they'll bring in. Then I suppose the other news that's floating around is a Māori party and its supporters, obviously big protests and disruptions yesterday, and then a declaration. They've declared their own parliament. They've declared their own parliament. Well, one of the most striking elements I note there, of course, is they'll want their own parliament. They've declared they are opening their own parliament, but they'll want everyone else to pay for it. And then the question I have for the Māori party MPs is, if they have now declared, as they have, their own parliament, will they be leaving the parliament? Will they be giving back all the money that they are paid? In a sense, is their money going to be placed where their mouth is? I'm not so optimistic on that. And the other thing I would note is a lot of this protest has been couched in the language of revolution and a lot of socialistic and Marxist principles. And I just think that's quite funny, actually, because that's really the Māori Party appropriating concepts from Europe, from European thinkers of a couple of hundred years ago. And I just wonder if the MPs have noted that in their thinking. But I think overall that's a sideshow. That's my own view. I think that the substantial element is the books are in pretty bad shape. The government's tightening the belt as best they can, but they see tax cuts as one way to give back to New Zealanders in an attempt to, if you will, reinvigorate the economy.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, joining us now is Nick Han. He is the Education Partnership Manager for the Free Speech Union. Anyone who knows me knows I'm a great proponent of free speech. I love the work which the Free Speech Union does, and it's just fantastic to have Nick along today. Amongst many things, he's actually running something called Speak Up. So the first thing I need to let you know, Nick, is that we've called this show Speak Free. It's probably partly plagiarised. Whether it was inspired by you, we can debate that off camera, or off audio, strictly speaking. Hey, but Nick, welcome along.
Thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you're working in the education space, and particularly with
young people, a relatively new initiative within the Free Speech Union. As someone who's a leader in this space, what are you seeing in general with our young people when it comes to free speech? Do they see it as something fantastic, or are they wary, or they just don't really understand?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a new initiative on our part. But personally, I mean, I've worked as a high school teacher for the past 7 years, and before that I worked with at-risk youth. So just sort of anecdotally or personally, I can basically attest to the fact that a lot of young people really just aren't getting the basics. They're not even being introduced to the idea or the concept of free speech really in any kind of formal way in their education. Now, that's not true necessarily of some private schools, but certainly in the public sector, it really depends on whether you have a teacher, you know, a classroom teacher that happens to use that approach where they encourage free speech. So, coming into this role and into this work, I guess I see it as a major opportunity to kind of reset. And so as an organization, we've been trying to react to a lot of situations, you know, trying to help people put out some fires where perhaps professionally or in some sort of public space, they're being, silenced or censored. And we've realized that really the critical next stage is actually reaching the next generation. We are going to see, you know, international trends, they're being reflected here. We're going to see a real silencing, a real sort of chilling of free speech culture. And that's a real concern, a real concern.
Oh, I'd completely echo that as someone who, look, the Free Speech Union, you guys have experienced the cancelling dynamics, or at least the attempts I certainly have over time, and we all know many, many cases across the country where people are being deplatformed. Right across, I might add, the political spectrum. I see the other day in Wellington, Dr. Mike Joy, you know, a water scientist. Some would see him as controversial. Personally, I think he's just got a perspective. But was it the Wellington Library did or tried to cancel him? So this is widespread. But have you found then, Nick, and obviously with your experience in teaching and now in this lead role, is it that the young people are just not thinking about free speech, or are they, again, it's generalization, are they celebrating the cancel culture? Have they been inculcated through teachers, media and others to celebrate the cancel culture? I mean, what are you seeing there?
I think there's a combination of things. And of course, you can't say that one student has, the same view as the next. But I would say that the general kind of atmosphere in education and amongst young people is that the Overton window, you know, that sort of range of accepted opinions or views that you could express in society, that really has narrowed, or at least it's shifted perhaps. And again, we're not, you know, politically aligned in the sense that we're not taking a substantive view on most political issues unless they affect things like free speech and civil liberties. But, you know, the real concern is that there just isn't the scope anymore to talk about things that even 10, 15 years ago you could have easily talked about in classrooms or in a public space. And so I think a lot of young people just don't know how far they can go in terms of the range of topics they can talk about. And there's other aspects. I mean, there's a huge, you know, emphasis now or push towards being empathic, you know, thinking of how does it feel to be in someone else's shoes, which of course is a very important, I think, essential quality that we should be instilling in young people. But that's coming at the expense of rational thought. It's coming at the expense of evidence-based argument. And of course, you know, it doesn't have to be that just because we're all about free speech, we have to be uncivil. You know, it's about trying to convince young people this is not a screaming match. This is actually something where we could be really respectful while not necessarily seeing eye to eye about a particular topic. But, you know, knowing in the end we're human beings, we've got to show that respect towards each other, recognize the inherent dignity that other people have and hope they show it back.
Well, that's sort of the sad observation on my part, and again, obviously no expert, but I see a lot of young people are being, if you will, taught or encouraged towards the activist model, quite aggressive activism, actually. So go out, yell, protest, scream, yell, intimidate. I mean, these are all, again, general statements, but that's what I see a lot of people sort of being encouraged to instead of actually good, rational debate. And the second thing for me, certainly, I mean, empathy is absolutely important. Believe it or not, spent most of my life trying to empathize and help people, but I would always make the argument perhaps it's the philosopher in me, Nick, that you have to know who to empathise with, when and why. In other words, there needs to be some, if you will, rational thought or consideration before that of how much empathy to display or not. It's not just something that should just be automatically thrown around. Otherwise, it becomes, in my view, meaningless. But I also wonder, what is it that takes away that then natural questioning for young people? And the context for me is this. I've got five step kids. They're all amazing. They're older now. But, you know, when they're really young, they ask all sorts of questions. You know, as a step-parent, they ask a question around the restaurant table where you go, oh, my God, it's not that it was bad, but it's just an innocent young question, but our sensibilities kick in. But how and why is that natural questioning, it seems, being taken away from young ones that now they won't touch, particularly at high school level, they just won't touch a lot of issues. It doesn't matter if it's around COVID to gender identity, the treaty, they just won't touch it. How's that been drawn out of them? What stopped them? Sorry, very long question.
No. I'm absolutely, relevant to this whole thing. I suppose I would see it as being a natural impulse to question, you know, every three-year-old, four-year-old, I've got, you know, younger kids, they will ask you why, and, you know, how does that work? You know, what's this about? And so that's a natural impulse. What often happens, unfortunately, in modern education, is that natural impulse is not necessarily completely stamped out, but people steer it, like I said before, into a particular, you know, range of topics to discuss, and they avoid those things that are considered taboo at the time in the culture. The other thing, I guess, is that as people get older, there is that also natural impulse to try and ensure that there's some kind of social cohesion. You know, they don't want to get offside with their neighbours, with their work colleagues, and so on. And I think as a result of that, it's very easy to lean into that impulse and start to, you know, kind of stifle or at least narrow the curiosity that we're born with. And so, you know, you're dealing with those two kind of impulses at different stages in life. And the key thing for me is free speech is always something that has to be actively promoted. It has to be something that you remind yourself of and other people of, and hopefully they do that for you, because it really takes work. You know, it's so much easier just to go, no, I won't say anything. I'm going to mind my own business, stay in the corner, and, you know, and hope it all goes okay. That, unfortunately, just doesn't work in a democracy. So we're going to have young people who really do think that they have to defer to the so-called experts in the room every time there's an issue that they're just not familiar with. And even those they are familiar with, they'll say, well, I don't know that my own personal experience counts here, so I'm not going to bring it into the conversation.
You highlight for me actually a really important dynamic, as I understand it, so correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, at one level we're talking about young people and what's happening to them and how they're acting, but actually there's also the older generation, I'll put myself in there, not so much your good self, but it's also a responsibility on us as older ones to make sure we are allowing that to happen. Because you're right, I think there's a natural tendency, including in myself, that you go, okay, I've got these views and I'm pretty sure they're right and we want to impart those. But there can be that human tendency to impart things too strongly or to narrow cast out other views. So, yeah, it's one thing to talk about young people as we're doing, but at the same time, there's a responsibility on the older generations to allow the young ones to explore wonderful ideas. And as I've also found sometimes what I think are absolutely crazy, but, you know, all power to them. So in terms then of what you're leading, you are running a program, is it called Speak Up? Tell us about this program in schools, and are you getting into many schools? Are they opening the doors to you?
Yeah, well, we've just started the program, so this academic year, and we've called it Speak Up for the obvious reason that we want people actually to use their voices, you know, use their brains, use their voices. We're really about encouraging students to see this as a constructive model of free speech. You know, free speech in its essence is something that helps advance ideas, arguments, you know, discourse, and it gets people further along that sort of path towards greater knowledge and ultimately sort of some pursuit of truth. And so we've called it Speak Up. We're going into high schools. We've been to a few already. But really the thing is we can cast the net wide, you know, but there are a lot of people who are nervous in the education sector. I wouldn't say that necessarily the opposition is so great that no one's letting us in, but people are nervous. And we're really just trying to reach out and say, particularly just to, you know, subject teachers, you know, this doesn't have to be a school assembly thing. Could just be that you have a class and maybe you're a history teacher and you are interested in civil rights and how that has progressed over the last, you know, 100, 200 years. So that's where we can actually tailor some of what we do. We come in and we'll talk about, well, you know, why did Martin Luther King, you know, achieve what he did? Why did people like John Lewis, who worked with King, continue to emphasize free speech as a, you know, as probably the most important tool in the civil rights campaigners, you know, toolbox? It's a method, you know, that's what we're really trying to get across to people. So we could talk to history classes, but we could also talk to science classes. You know, the free speech touches pretty much every domain in education. And again, we're not about a substantive position on a political topic or an ideological topic. We're really emphasizing this is a method. This is how we can advance discourse, debate, and ultimately knowledge and truth.
Which I think is great. Look, it's one of the strengths, says me, as a layman compared to you, or rather someone who doesn't work with the Free Speech Union. But one of the things I admire what you and the team do is you are, if you will, politically agnostic. You're not left, you're not right. In fact, I mean, you know, if anyone has taken the time to look at who sits both in the team and also on your council, the directors, it's a broad spectrum of people. And, you know, I've admired and often noted the flack you guys get in social media from both sides, which tells me you're doing the right thing. So you'll be saying, hey, look, this group here has the right to hold whatever it wants to do, and the opposite view also. So really, really valuable. I mean, are you finding, obviously it's a new program, so early days, but are at least some schools opening up, or are you facing also some pretty fierce knockbacks?
Well, I wouldn't say fierce. I mean, it's easy for schools to just go silent. And that's, you know, that's the problem, really, we're seeing across the board, whether it's in schools or, you know, out there in society generally. It is just the, you know, the easy kind of default position to take. I'm not going to open my mouth. I'm not going to risk, you know, having a person come in and run a session in my classroom that might upset a parent or two or a student or two, despite the fact that the overwhelming, you know, good that's derived from these sorts of exercises is really indisputable, I think. It's setting young people up ideally with not just the skills, but a deeper, you know, democratic ethos or philosophy that's going to help keep our democracy going. You know, that's sort of a long-winded way of saying we really need people to be a bit braver and have these conversations. And I don't think that, I mean, I wouldn't say that, look, every teacher out there is terrified and no one wants to talk about this. A lot of teachers are just busy. They're trying to get through the curriculum expectations that they have and meet their goals. But, you know, this conversation isn't actively being promoted across our education sector. And I worked in a private school, you know, for 7 years, and we were doing stuff in terms of epistemology, so that, you know, sort of the study of how we know and why we think we know certain things and whether we do or not. And I ran a particular course for senior students, preparing them for some of the top universities in the world. And we had kids go off to Harvard and Oxford and Cambridge as a result of this. And what we found, you know, using that particular program is it really does totally transform their view of knowledge and whatever the subject, the discipline they're going into. And it makes it, in many cases, come alive for them. It isn't just some kind of, you know, musty old, you know, accepted, received opinion, but it's something that could be challenged, you know, if there's an opportunity to. And free speech, you know, speaking up is how you do that, whether it's academically or in public space or in media or whatever.
Well, it's one of the paradoxes to me in modern society, which I'll make a slightly political point here, and so I'm not trying to drag you into it, but sort of the progressive side of things says we've got to be individuals and we've got to be celebrated as we are, and we must be affirmed for being individuals, which in some ways is a good thing. But then when it comes to freely speaking your ideas, no, not that. Not that part of your identity. And it's like, but that's one of the most core elements, to be able to explore, blunder, and everything else in between around ideas. The other thing I might note is I was not expecting the word epistemology to appear today. I think that's the word for the show, epistemology. We can all look that up. Next week, eschatology. No, love it. But I just think it's just so vitally important, as you say, for the development of young minds. And my wife's a teacher. She would agree with you. She would fully agree with you of just the huge workload. But I think the sad thing I found, granted, when I was an MP and visiting schools, is, again, in very general terms, not a lot of discussion in this space in public. But what really concerned me was how often teachers, sometimes principals, in the school corridors, or if I met them in the street the next day, would more discreetly tell me their concerns and worries, particularly around free speech, the ability to discuss ideas. And it's always saddened me more than anything that, yeah, even in that environment, that the leaders, the teachers, have a view but don't always feel themselves free to speak. So you guys clearly have a big challenge ahead of you, and I'm excited by this Speak Up project. So we'll have to have you back on to tell us how it's going.
Thanks.
But one last, well, probably one last question. I'm a former politician. When I say one, it could be two. Who knows? Who trusts me? But no, seriously, you've recently had Jonathan Rauch out. Do you want to quickly tell listeners who he was and what he was doing here? Granted, he's gone now, but formidable speaker.
Yeah. Jonathan Rauch is a really, you know, prominent journalist from the US. You know, he's written and spoken extensively on academic freedom, but also on civil rights and the really, really crucial role that free speech plays in civil rights campaigns. Now, I mean, some people, you know, may agree with his politics, some people may not, but I wouldn't say there's anything particularly radical about his politics. He he's campaigned for certain things that obviously some, particularly conservatives, would maybe disagree with. But what really mattered with him, I think, in terms of what he presented, was he was talking about that, you know, the concern for minorities, which is, of course, a genuine one in the sense that I think anyone should be looking out for those who are in the minority, who may not necessarily get seen, recognized in the public space and in politics. But he was making the point that if really we do care about minorities and their rights, then free speech is the ultimate means by which they can actually have some purchase, some share in the public conversation, public debate, and they can be heard because of free speech. I mean, it should be a no-brainer, but it took, you know, I guess someone like him, who's very erudite and articulate, expressing that point, you know, just to remind a lot of people that's what if we really ask genuinely serious about protecting the underdog or the minority or whoever it might be, then surely free speech for everybody is the way in which those minorities have a say. So that was something I think I particularly took away from his time here.
Oh, he's 100% correct. I mean, you've used the term a couple of times that free speech is foundational to our democracy. Without it, you know, what's the point, but it's one of the key pillars. Nick, I'm exceptionally grateful that you've come on to chat with us. As a heads up and a warning, we'll have you back. If you'll have us back, we could love to chat more. So everyone, that was Nick Hayne. He is the Education and Partnership Manager at the Free Speech Union. If you haven't checked them out online, please do so. And as with all things, and I'm sure Nick would agree, make sure you freely speak and allow others to freely speak too. So thanks for your time, Nick.
Thanks, Simon. Cheers.
We do this because we care for honesty. We care for the future of this country, of our children and generations to come. You know what? It's more important to be noisy than nice.
Rate bills in Southland this year talking 20% rate increases on 20% a couple of years ago. It's out of control. The redistribution machine is completely destroying the energy of productive people.
The problem we have today is that governments are pressured by mainstream media, big money, special interests, and international organisations. These organisations that seek to shape our society, to shape the way we live to suit their agenda. It's something we might call a compliance model.
We used to pay 50 cents for the Herald every day, and that's when we got the news we wanted. When you stopped paying for the news, the advertisers and the people behind the news organisations started paying for the news. So you can see that definite behavioural shift, which is whoever's paying you is what your messaging is going to be.
Some people out there enjoy the left and right division, the debate, the fighting, but I for one don't see that as a productive way forward in creating a future for our tamariki. You can argue until the cows come home, but people right now are so strong in their beliefs, so finding that common ground, that common overlap of left, right, woke, awake, is vital to any melting pot of a nation.
We're going through this information revolution. We've got the internet now, so all this information is there. And I always say to people, look, we went down there thinking that we were fighting for freedom, but the bigger picture on that is that they were really fighting to keep control of information. You know, that's what it's actually about. These controllers of information are losing control because information's become like water now. You know, you block it here, it'll pop up somewhere else.
They keep telling us that democracy is dying because of the media companies. But you know, they've sat there smugly telling us how to live our lives for, as far as I can remember, thinking they're the smartest people in the room, but they didn't see this coming.
Well, welcome back, everyone. This is the mailbag session. This is new for me. I'm not getting feedback from people. I've been very, very used to that. But this is the first time I'll be doing this on Reality Check Radio here on Speak Free. And I'm excited. I really am. There's actually quite a lot of feedback. I'm not going to be able to get to each and every one. But we've got a few areas to touch on today, I think. I've tried to categorize the general feedback. We've got feedback on what happened around Taiwan. We've even got some feedback about Rachel, but I might share that. Well, I will be sharing that with her. And then the two of us discussing it with you, the need to talk about what happened during the COVID days. And then a good number of people were messaging, asking about the protest in Parliament and what I was doing, or rather not doing. So I thought this is a really good chance to talk to all of that. I mean, as always, it's important to hear your feedback. So once again, if you need to email, use inbox@realitycheck.radio. And you can also text message to 2057. So get in touch. Love to hear from you each week. As a quick aside, if you know me, or some of you will who listen, you know I could talk for hours. I could literally prattle on for a topic for hours. But I've always found it better, and when I hold public meetings or I used to give lectures, I've always found it better to be responding to people. So that's you. So let me know what's on your mind. Ask us anything. If I find the question is so outlandish, I won't answer that if you're, you know, asking the password to my email system. But, you know, jokes aside, hit me up. What's on your mind? What topic should I be discussing? I'll do my best to read it out. So let's jump right back in. I tossed a coin literally of whether I start with the positives, the more challenging, and the coin landed in the positive favor. So I'll start with some lovely messages. And then start, all the messages were lovely. All the messages were lovely. But some of the lovely feedback from last week was to say, look, send Simon my thanks for coming on as a presenter, and you'll hopefully bring in some mainstream people. So thanks for that, Jackie. Beth says, I'm an invaluable addition to the lineup. Well, thank you. I think actually, Beth, we have an amazing array of presenters, and I'm quite humbled to be part of them. She also says you have a great interaction and engagement with your guests. So again, thank you, Beth. Another welcome message, and great to have international perspectives. That's from Peter in Hamilton. He says he's very much looking forward to guests that I can also bring to the table. So, well, hopefully you've enjoyed, we'll be enjoying today's guests. And also, I'm looking forward to the coming weeks, which will be brilliant. Sean is very sweet. He says, I'm a massive loss to politics, and he suggests I'm a rather astute and articulate person with integrity. Well, I try to be, believe it or not. And he's saying, will I hopefully return to politics? Well, at this point, Sean, I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm not trying to be an ex-politician. There's no weasel words here. I think my time in, if you will, politics or the parliamentary side is over. I've sort of been there, done that. And then some lovely comments. Well, I thought they were lovely from Sarah. And it was also echoed by the likes of Jen and Jan that they thought, I'll just read what they wrote. They said, always appreciated his rational thought and discussion throughout the COVID years and how he particularly stood up for free speech. And Sarah in particular says she's looking forward to hearing more and seeing how this show develops. But a solid start. Well, thank you, Sarah. I thought it was too.
I thought it was too, as I mentioned last week, as I was going through the show, I was nervous. But we've got through it. Some lovely feedback to the Taiwanese ambassador or de facto ambassador, Joanne Oh. Viv says, boom, boom. That was a Taiwan information download. The intellectual debate has been raised again. Lisa says she was going to tune in to hear her favourite show, but then, so that'll be, actually there's so many favourite shows, I better not name any particular ones, but she realised there was a change of schedule, happened to hear mine, and she said she enjoyed the discussion. Joe says the lady was okay to listen until she started going hard on the COVID nonsense. She wanted to know, well, Joe, this is, what's the situation with health in Taiwan now these days? I think, Joe, they've basically returned to normal, if I could phrase it that way, but actually a good encouragement for me to have asked that question. Kingsley writes, the WHO, the World Health Organization, lots of talk about leaving it. The benefits of global control are few, and he thinks that's the same with the WEF, the World Economic Forum and the UN. And also Paul notes similar ways. He says, great start, Simon, but your guess lost me, though, on the pandemic. That was mostly a false positive pandemic. So thank you for that, Paul. And then Anne, again, similar. Listening to the interview, she says, with Joanne Oh, my jaw dropped. We created our own COVID vaccines, which are as effective as the overseas ones. So Anne's quoting Joanne there. And she's asking, why am I cheering this woman on? Well, I think one thing we'll find on the show is I'm going to bring in a number of people with a number of perspectives. Part of my, if you will, free speech thought is that people need to be able to put the ideas out there, and then we either like them or we don't. I think particularly, if I might, guys, around the Joanne interview, a really important thing for Taiwan is not as much championing all and every element of the World Health Organization, but why it's important to Taiwan is by becoming a member, it affirms their right to exist. Or putting it in the negative, the fact that Taiwan's excluded, and some of you will say that's brilliant, but for Taiwanese, they're going, hey, we are part of this world. We are a country, we're a nation, and we should be recognized as such. But the other, and maybe it was a bit subtle, but one of the things we did talk about with the failings of the World Health Organization, how they've politicized the relationship with Taiwan. And I saw that as a bit of a hint in the wider dynamics around the way that the WHO operates. In other words, we should be concerned. We should be concerned about the political overtones in an organization that's meant to be focused on health. And finally on this, there was no name associated, but the listener might recognize it. She says, thanks so much for forging relationships with other nations. It was really enlightening to understand the real threats from the CCP, or the Chinese Communist Party, to Taiwanese people. And I hope that the Kiwi Tairinga, that means ears, our Tairinga will listen, learn more, and use our influence to create peaceful change in supporting the People's Republic of China's right to live independently and free from evil intent. I think it's right. Now, Tracy writes, and she's echoing a few people who wrote in around that we need to talk about the COVID days. So I'm going to try and paraphrase this. She says, Simon was asking for ideas for things we might want to talk about and like to hear more stories like my own, she says. On all the platforms that we love, there are constant mentions of lost or damaged relationships because of differing views on the vaccines and other COVID issues. But often they don't really get into details, the nitty-gritty. I'd like to hear stories or multiple bite-sized bits about the more nutty, bizarre, irrational, even funny things that were said or done by people, their spouses, family, friends, neighbours, colleagues, and employers. And I'm really curious how things are now. And that's from Tracy here in Auckland. Absolutely. It's one of the things, Tracy, and obviously all of you listening, that I've been struck with right throughout COVID and right up till today is the deep resentments which are still there. I feel them, and maybe I can elucidate on that another time, but there are still deep resentments, and there are a number of people, and they were the ones who primarily acted very aggressively and dismissively of other New Zealanders, the ones who wouldn't let their children play with those who were not vaccinated and so forth. They don't want to talk about it often now. They just want to dismiss the experiences of the past. And I think we do need to talk about it. As I say, there's deep deep resentment. And the only way we're going to be able to move through that is a proper, full and open discussion. And I really have a problem. I've challenged a few people over recent weeks and months, actually, who, again, try to forget the way they behaved. They behaved during the COVID days. So I'm with you, Tracy. So let's see if we can pull out some of those stories. And then, as you might expect, there are a number of messages around the protest at Parliament. And obviously, I was one of the MPs at the time, and the rightful question and challenge to me of why I didn't turn up. So I'll read a couple of those messages to give you a flavour, and then I'll quickly respond to that. It won't be the first time you've heard me respond, but I think it's important to stay on the front foot with these things. So Danny from Maunganui says, "Hi, Simon. I've always held you in the highest regard, enjoying your ability to rationally address the important issues, and welcome your involvement here at RCR. However, I'll take issue with you over a reply you made on RCR with Paul Brennan. When asked why you did not come out and meet the parliamentary protesters, you said that you would have been eviscerated by your colleagues and that the party leadership had you done so, that it would have been career-ending, that you thought it a hill not worth dying on." Danny writes, "The protest was a spontaneous, unplanned cry from people who had their human rights trampled, from people who instinctively knew there was something seriously wrong, even evil happening. Not a hill you, as in me, Simon, would die on. These people lost careers, businesses, income, marriages, barred from churches, entering shops, sports clubs, book clubs, and so on, from travel, from restaurants, and the list goes on and on. It was traumatic, devastating, even life-ending in suicides. Yet they died on that hill. They showed courage that not one of you in our parliament had. Your collective self-interest overrode your consciences. Shame on you all." And Stephen, so that was from Danny. So thank you, Danny. And from Stephen, he says, "Good morning. I see that Simon has a new show at RCR advocating for free speech, a laudable goal. However, I am struggling to understand something. Was Simon not one of the 120 or so MPs who deliberately ignored the protesters?" And so that's from Stephen. So I had a few like that, and I welcome them. So please continue to make your voices heard. I suppose my very quick feedback, and maybe I can do a longer segment on this sometime, we all make our choices. And, you know, that's one of the things I've always respected. Those of you who chose to be at the protest, those that wanted to but couldn't but still chose to express in different ways. And, yeah, I did make my choice. It was a difficult decision. I think, you know, I can't speak for every MP, but the ones I was close to, we all struggle with it in many ways. And yeah, it wasn't the hill to die on for me. And that's not a reflection on what happened, the importance of what was occurring, or the pain that people were going through. It was a calculation, for want of a better word, on the basis that I wanted, or I felt I had to keep speaking. And I was able to keep speaking. I wrote my speeches, actually wrote articles. I gave various speeches, pushing as far as I felt I could on the topic. And to continue advocating, actually. And I suppose that's my key point. Had I come out at the time and I look back, yep, it might have been good for a short time, but I do believe I would have been eviscerated. My career would have been over. And then I wouldn't be able to do those speeches. I wouldn't have been able to write, querying much of the stupidity that was going on. And I suppose the other point I would make, and these are reasons, I never see them as excuses, they're reasons. I was very aware of what was going on. I mean, very clear what was being said and expressed at the protest itself. But I've got friends and family who, like many of you, were directly affected. I talked to them. I had many hundreds, if not probably thousands, of constituents that I engaged with, both in Wellington on the streets, but certainly back in my electorate. So very, very aware of what was going on, and in many ways trying to help them in different ways, be it in their business exemptions and so forth. I probably would just try to suggest that, again, had I made a dramatic entry, for want of a better term, at the protest, a lot of that work and advocacy and support of people in my electorate, I wouldn't have been able to do. It's something I've been able to carry on doing. So that's just sort of a quick response there. But again, I really appreciate the thoughts and feedback, and I don't underestimate the pain and the hurt which continues to this day. And look, the last comment, because I'm probably going over time, I don't know about you guys, 2 hours seems like a long time, and then before you know it, I'm coming up to the end of it. The last comment I'll read today is, you have a problem, Simon. Well, don't we know it? So, you have a problem, Simon. Your first show has set a very high bar, so I'll be looking forward to seeing how you can match that. Three very good guests, all much enjoyed here. My thanks to you and the team. So thank you very much for that. And as I wrap up Mailbag, can I echo that? The thanks to the team. There's a whole crew of people behind me and the other hosts on RCR who make this happen. But the biggest team is all of you as listeners. So that's the Mailbag for this week. Please get back in touch. Thoughts, challenges, feedback, email me at inbox@realitycheck.radio or send your text to 2057.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Hi, everyone. Well, look, an exciting show today. I have Dr. Paul Moon with me. He is a professor of history at AUT, obviously here in Auckland. He's a prolific writer, commentator, and, of course, historian. So welcome, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing really, really, really well. Hey, it's nice to reconnect with you. And first question I've got to ask you, I've told you Dr. Paul Moon, but you are a professor. So have I completely mistitled you?
No, not at all. And I'd prefer just Paul. I'm not very big into titles at all. So Paul's much easier.
Oh, well, we'll keep running with Paul. So, listeners, this morning we've got quite a lot to talk about. One of it is obviously the books that Paul is writing. Very, very, well, as I say, prolific writer. But also, I would say, one of our eminent and well-outspoken historians. So we want to talk a little bit about history. What's history about? Why is it important? But I said at the start, Paul, you're prolific. You're prolific with your writing. You've very kindly given me over recent times a copy of your Auckland, the 20th century story, Colonising New Zealand. Fantastic books, great reads. And most recently, you've just released a biography of Arne's Westra. So first and foremost, how do you find the time to write all these books?
Well, there's probably, I don't know, probably two ways of answering that. One of them is that I do work long hours. The extreme case was with the Arne's Westra biography, where there were some days I was getting close to 20 hours a day on it. So that's a long day, and you get 4 hours sleep and then you're back into it. And it requires a lot of physical preparation, believe it or not, to do that sort of thing. But the other thing is I've, very early on, and I got this from music, I realized that there are certain composers who never produced drafts of their music. Everything they wrote was in the final form. And I thought, that's interesting. And I remember trying to write a book like that, and it took a very long time because every sentence had to be crafted as though it was the final version. But over time, you get more practiced at it. So now I'll write a book, and apart from a few commas or spelling mistakes, what I draft is the final version. And it saves having to go through umpteen different drafts, which consumes months and months. So that's part of it as well.
That's fantastic. And I better be clear, my next comment's not putting me anywhere on the level that you do or work. But I recall in my early university days, when I had brown hair, long time ago, would actually handwrite my essays, you know, 3,000 or 5,000 words, and then I would type them up. And it took me about a year, as stupid as I am, to go, why don't I just type them first? Why am I doubling up my work? So I've learnt another further element from your good self here. So, as I say, you've written many, many books, but your latest is on Arne's. And I probably pronounced that wrong, and apologies to her and, of course, to you. But she's a remarkable New Zealander and also originally from the Netherlands, or some will know as Hollands. Tell us about her, her life, why you wrote the book.
I was reasonably familiar with her photographs. I think a lot of people have seen them and not know even who took them. she's been photographing in New Zealand, or she was, from the late 1950s, really up until her death last year. So a very prolific photographer, over 300,000 photographs. And this is in the days when you have a film and a camera. So that's a lot of work. And she really documented almost every aspect of New Zealand society over that period. If you want to know what's happening at a farm stock sale, school playground, sex workers, just about anything you can imagine, she took photographs of it, and of a standard that one expert who's an academic in this field, worked for 20 years lecturing photography, has said he puts from the top five social documentary photographers in the post-war era anywhere in the world. That's how good she was. She won a number of international awards, but not really recognized here, apart from the very controversial Wash Day at the Par, which is a primary school journal that was published in 1964, which depicted a Maori family in relative poverty, but a very loving, happy, caring, nurturing family. There were protests about that back in 1964, that it depicted Maori in a state of poverty, and the Maori Women's Welfare League said this is unacceptable. The campaign against that journal reached the point, and it came to an extraordinary point, where the Department of Education, as it then was, said, we're going to recall all 38,000 copies of that journal and pulp them. So they did. They instructed all the primary schools in New Zealand to send that school journal back to Wellington, and it was trucked off to a site where it was destroyed. Now, a few copies survived, quite a few copies, probably 100 or 200, but the majority of that 38,000 were destroyed. And this was very early on in her career. She's still in her late 20s. And that was a devastating blow, but she persisted with photography and produced really some of the most remarkable photographs we've got of our country. And I've described it in the book as like a national photo album.
Oh, I found it quite remarkable. I was not aware that I was familiar with her work. A little bit of what you said earlier, there are these photos, these images, which we see as part of our history, but I had never, and it's a shame on me, thought about who was behind them. And it was only when you published your book and started talking about it that I realized who it was. She was quite, well, maybe this is more reflection on me, Paul, that I didn't take the time to know, but she strikes me rather as a bit of an enigma, or someone who didn't seek the limelight. Would that be a fair comment?
To start off with, she had her challenges, and they're laid out in the book, a very abusive upbringing, and some mental health challenges along the way that got quite serious at one stage. When you research someone, you go into all sorts of odd avenues. One of them is I looked at her finances at one stage and found out that for 1 year, her earnings were half the minimum pay for that year. So she really struggled financially for a lot of her career. Most people give up that type of career that she had in about 18 months. She did it for over six decades. So very, very committed. And she had a particular eye for capturing moments that very few photographers had. The consequence is these are works of supreme quality in terms of documentary photography, but they're also supreme works of art photography. And that's very rare to do that for a short period, but for six decades, it's almost unheard of internationally.
So would you say she was clearly someone driven by passion, or was it also a vocation? As you say, she was making very little money, as a lot of artists find, but she persevered. So what drove her, do you think? Was it just the love of the art, the people, or a sense of mission?
I think there are probably a couple of things, and I don't know the full answer. I don't think anyone does, and I suspect perhaps not even she would be aware of it. I don't know. But certainly when you're that good at something, there is a compulsion to work at it. Interestingly, she never got into a rut. She never repeated the same technique, as good as it was, over and over again. She was always exploring new ways of doing things. I think also, to a degree, when you're so focused on a particular undertaking, especially if it's a creative undertaking, your mind shunts to the periphery some of the day-to-day challenges you face because you're just focused on that. If you have and I'm not a psychologist or anything, but if you do have a problem that's bearing down on you, one way of dealing with that is to push it to the edge, to keep it out of sight while you're working on this. And I think that can form a pattern. And she almost conceded something to that effect in the early 90s in some notes she wrote to herself, that photography was a way of grappling with issues.
Obviously, I didn't know her, but in my own life and background, dealt with a lot of people in different situations. And one of the things I've noticed, some of the people with the darkest demons are often the most creative, outgoing, and generous. It's sort of the flip side of coins. So if you have someone like myself who's relatively boring, boringly in life, boringly creative, but actually some people have said, yeah, it's the light and dark, yin and yang, all of that. But it sounds like she had her struggles and yet such a life, yeah, a life-giving creativity that she was able to generate and share with us.
Very much so. Yes, and that's the other thing. She absolutely wasn't driven by profit. And you might think, well, that's a naive approach, but it's also a liberating approach, because then she could focus on what was important. The images she took are ones that she cared about, not that she was being paid to do. And so you get that sense of care and deep interest in those images, and that just radiates out of them, and you look at them, and it's very hard to look at an Answestra photograph and just briefly give it a glance and move on. They're absorbing, and the more you look at them, the more you get absorbed by them.
Well, one that's in your book or you've shared on social media is a young Māori boy. And I'm going to struggle with this because we're on radio. There's no visuals, so I'll see if I can describe it and certainly correct me. But he's leaning up against a window and she's photographed him, but part of his body is manifest, if you will, through the window. But it's perfectly formed. It's not distorted, yet at the same time we're actually seeing him through a medium, through the glass, and I've just been intrigued by it. It just keeps drawing me in.
It does. The context of that is, this is the period of urban migration where vast number of Māori started to move from rural areas into the towns and cities, particularly Auckland and Wellington. So here's this young teenager. And of course, the temptation of the cities was all the glamour, or part of it anyway, the bright lights, the entertainment, and so on. And this is a dreary, rainy day, and he's in this street, and it's grim. His face reflects that. He's got a sort of a pondering look on his face, and there's no sense of glamour whatsoever. And then she, as you say, she plays with this idea of looking through glass windows, looking at reflections, and there's attention in so many of her photographs, and this is one of them, that it's almost like a puzzle you're trying to resolve, and you never get to the point of resolution. There's always something slightly off balance or slightly tense that you can't sort out. And that's the mark of a person who's really at the top of their game when it comes to that sort of photography.
Well, you've encapsulated for me for a lot of the dynamic. It just keeps drawing me in. Even as I was preparing for this interview, I kept going back and looking at it. And each time, for me, saw and then found something new. And I suppose that, as you say, speaks to the quality of her work. Mm. She's obviously and sadly passed on. But if I can ask, how did you get involved with her? What drew you to this story? As I say, you've written about Auckland. You've written about the Edwardian. You've spoken about colonisation. What drew you to her story?
Well, I was familiar with the Wash Day at the Pass story since the 80s. I was interested in her photographs, and the more I looked at them, the more I became interested in them. And I went to get her biography to find out who was behind all these photographs. There wasn't a biography, and I realised at this point she was in her early 80s, and I thought, not only when you're at that age have you not got many years left, but probably the people who were part of your career, your friends and colleagues early on, we're talking about the 60s and 70s here, they're probably of the same age. And I thought, if there's going to be a record of her life, it has to be done pretty promptly. So, and I've never done this before, and I've never done it since. I just emailed her, a complete stranger, and said, my name is Paul Moon, effectively I'm a historian, I'd like to write your biography. And she never replied. But what happened in the meantime, after months, there was no reply, and I thought, well, this isn't going to happen. And that was okay, so I just parked it there. But she had spent all that time contacting numerous people trying to find out about me, to find out, could I do a good job, was I reliable, all that sort of thing. And then her agent got in touch with me after many months, and we met, and that turned out to be sort of another stage in the interview process almost. Then I met her, and then we chatted and so on, and she consented for the book to be written, and sadly shortly afterwards she died. But there was a lot of information that we were able to get, months and months of interview transcript, all her private papers, all her correspondence, and that was really the backbone of the book, and that's how it came about.
Remarkable in itself, but says me again, what a hint of her own personality that she's taken the time to research who you were, wanted to be careful, I suppose, also like constructing a shot. Take your time, work it out, don't just fire away. So just before we move on to a wider discussion of history in and of itself, as a historian, is there something in these images in themselves, not particularly her photographs, is there something deeper in imagery when it comes to history? You know, the whole picture says 1,000 words, and it's not to try and put up a false interplay between the written and the visual, but as a historian, do you see something quite profound in photography in particular?
Definitely, and that's a very good point, because, you know, I've made this point to some people recently that every couple of years there's some academic or some journalist in New Zealand who publishes a book or a paper on New Zealand identity, and they all fail. I gave the analogy, it's rather like clutching at fog. You can see it all around you, but if you try to grab a piece of fog to analyse it, you end up with nothing. It's elusive. And that's the nature of identity. It's a very complex concept. It may not even exist. The New Zealand identity might just be the composite of 5 million individual identities. But the idea of this, you know, so you can look through recent, the last 4 or 5 decades, things like the quarter acre section, that's quintessential New Zealand, or rugby, racing, beer. And then we move on to the southern man, the stoic, silent type, and on and on and on we go. None of them work. No, they're all stereotypes, they're all cliched, and they date very quickly. But if you want to describe what New Zealand is like, what the essence of being in New Zealand is like from 1960 to the present time, the single best way of doing that is looking at that collection of Hans Westra's photographs, because they cover everything. And you know when you look at these, I mean, there's a great photograph I saw recently of hers. She took it in a Lower Hutt primary school late one afternoon, it's empty, and she just took a photograph of the playground. And every person who grew up, say, in the 1970s in New Zealand or 60s, who went to a primary school, state school, and had a playground like that, we all did, it just resonates so much. That's the essence of that New Zealand experience at school. And then she's got them in other places as well. Shopping, for example, a marae, you name it. And so the cumulative effect of looking at these, you build up a sense, yes, this is the New Zealand identity. No writer will ever be able to do what she did. And she inadvertently created that sense of the country.
Again, I've used the word a few times, but it is quite profound. And I'm pleased to hear you say it, and I'm biased on this. It's because it's been one of my perspectives. I get quite frustrated in general when, be it politicians or others, have tried to find this, as you say, national identity. For me, it's always been akin to a teenager sitting in the mirror asking, who am I? It doesn't go particularly anywhere. And I like your fog analogy as well. But there is something, again, profound, deep, that draws us in through photography. Would you mind if I ask, do you think it's the same with video? Does video footage have the same depth? Or is there something about the sticky black and white 2D image which doesn't speak beyond colour? So you can see I'm not an artist, but it asks you to engage.
Yes, it does. Video footage is evocative as well. If you see, you know, if you have a, your 21st birthday, say, videoed, and then 20 years later you look at it, of course it's going to bring back memories. It has a nostalgic component to it. But with, as you say, with black and white photography, particularly when it's done of the quality that Ernst Westra did, it forces you to wrestle with it. It's not an easy task. You don't just look at it and go, oh, yes, tick, I remember that. You have to start engaging with that photograph. And in the course of engaging with it, the sense of relationship to the past deepens and it broadens. And the more you look at her photographs, the more it does that. Of course, the risk is that it's, it becomes almost like a prosthetic memory. It's something you haven't experienced personally, but you align it with what your sense of the past is about. And it's very powerful from that perspective.
Well, I'm just grateful you've taken the time to share her story, not only through photography, of course. I suppose a bit of a paradox. There's lots of words as well, but that's apt and appropriate for an historian. Before we switch to the wider discussion of history, tell our listeners how they can get hold of your book.
It's in bookshops, and I imagine it's available online as well. So if you search on the internet, it'll pop up somewhere.
Certainly encourage people to do so. So the little bit that I've seen of it so far is well worth engaging with. So again, Paul, thank you for sharing her story with us. Obviously, her photography, but also an element of New Zealand that's really appreciated. So, thinking then about the wider question of history, say you're a professor of history, it's something you've written prolifically around. I suppose the question is that some people raise with me, and as a student of philosophy myself, why is history important? Why should we bother to be looking at the past when life's so busy here in the present?
And that's one of the most common questions I get. Why bother studying something that's already happened? It seems futile. And of course, the question is misdirected because, and there are a number of reasons. One of them is that history is part of that architecture of our identity. So if you want to know who you are, the only way to answer that is through an examination of your history and then history more generally. Without that, you don't have much of a developed identity at all. It's that important. Stemming from that, of course, is a risk that you can start to recreate your identity depending on which bits of history you emphasize. And you see this in some countries when they gain independence. All of a sudden, the people are fervent, whatever it is, the new national state, and they realign elements of history to fortify that sense of collective identity. So history absolutely feeds into identity. And the other thing, at a more practical level, it's simply the best textbook for dealing with the realities of life that we have. No other way, no other source will guide you through challenges that you face in terms of whatever it is in the areas that you work in, apart from history. So if you've got a country that's arming itself and about to carry out military maneuvers on the border of another country, what does that mean? Well, there's enough historical information accessible now that we can get a sense of what the possibilities might mean, how to diffuse that, all these sorts of things. Without that knowledge, we just keep tripping up over the same mistake over and over again. And that's one of the problems of not being aware of history. You have this enforced forgetfulness. And so you keep tripping up over something because you've forgotten that someone's been on that route already. This is the mistake they made. We can learn from it. Or this is the technique they used. Again, we can take advantage of it.
Do you think, though, it's... Well, we obviously learn from history. Says me, the layman, to you, it gives us a vocabulary that we can use today to understand where we are. And I'm a great proponent of the concept of tradition, the Latin, which means to hand on. We pass things on generation to generation.
I think we'd disagree on that one. I think
really,
I'm sensing that you're using this in the context of a Catholic tradition in particular, and the Catholic Church cites tradition as the basis of so much of its authority for what it does. In a way, that's a bogus claim. And it's bogus because the tradition was new at some point. So take the tradition of purgatory or the tradition of limbo, where the church itself oscillates between, yes, this is true, no, it's not. The proponents, say, of limbo or purgatory will cite tradition, church tradition. But that's not an authority. That's just an accumulation of years for an idea. So if I propose to you that limbo applies to people up to the age of 19, which is absurd, really, is the original limbo concept in a way. You might think, well, that's a silly idea, Paul. But if that idea keeps circulating for the next 1,200 years, all of a sudden it's part of tradition and it has an authority that doesn't come from anything other than repetition and time.
That makes sense, actually, and a good challenge. So the concept that you're arguing here is that something like tradition, if it's not grounded in, if you will, a reality, it's just an idea that's been passed on and time gives it a authority that it may not deserve.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with tradition in itself. So some families might have a tradition of gathering at a certain time, or there might be traditions around certain practices such as funerals, relationships, whatever. And there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. But as an authority for how to act, I think you have to be a bit more discerning. And a lot of what happened during the Reformation was about challenging those traditions because they were found in some cases to be hollow.
Yeah, well, I gave a talk recently on that, actually, in terms of the notion of belief versus reality. Simply that we believe something simply because it's been our tradition doesn't actually make it true. You need objective reality. And I suppose, isn't that an element of what history or historians trying to do? Try to get in behind what's being discussed, observed, and go, what's the basis or the foundation?
They try to, but there are all sorts of pressures, obviously, on a historian, so that the field they work in might be too narrow, they might be influenced by the ideology of the day, or they might be fighting the ideology of the day, which in itself is an influence. So there's all these sorts of things that come to play, but there are established methods established over 200 or 300 years at least, of how to treat evidence, how to deal with different categories of evidence, how to prioritise them, how to see cause and effect, how not to see cause and effect. And all these techniques, when they're applied, help build a reasonably good picture of the past if they're handled correctly. It's not like the law where in a court case it's adversarial, where you've got one person arguing this point of view and selecting the evidence that helps their client, and the other person arguing the opposite, selecting a completely different set of evidence from the same pool. Historians try really to combine all evidence and let that speak for itself rather than make a case and then get the evidence to fit around it. Unfortunately, there are exceptions to that, not so much in history, but certainly in other disciplines, people have decided, I have a point of view and I will harness those points from the past that support my view.
My observation is that it is creeping into history now. Again, and it's a question as much as a statement to you, because I'm seeing a lot more people demanding their history and their interpretation and twisting things. In other words, they take a particular position on an issue, whatever it is, find the little bits and bits of bobs which support them, and off they go. And so they're twisting history to fit their ideology. And I better be clear, I don't think that I can sit with my interest in history and say, hey, I've got it perfectly right. I've got my own biases. But are we seeing more people, if you will, twisting history, that relativism, which we've seen across so many disciplines, is it now coming into history, or is these methods that you talk about robust enough to keep that at a distance?
I think you're right, that no one can claim that the history they've written is absolutely true. And if they do make that claim, I think they're showing a degree of lack of awareness of their own abilities. Of course, we're influenced by all sorts of things, even in the most essential things, the moral judgments. We look at a mass killing. Is that bad or good? Well, you could make the case that you shouldn't answer that as a historian. It's not your job to make a moral judgment about it. It's your job to portray what happened and why. Let the reader decide. But inevitably, we have to exercise moral judgments because we're moral beings. And not to do so, you can end up being too detached and too clinical, not give any meaning to things. Moral actions have moral consequences. So if someone does commit a mass murder, you could say, well, this is how many people were killed, this is why they did it, and so on. But there's going to be moral reactions, since you have to immerse yourself in the world of the community that's affected and so on, to get a sense of why people do what they do and why they react and so on. So yes, there will be biases, and we're bound by the time we live in, the issues we bring to our approach. But the method of dealing with evidence has to be adhered to. So, and again, the lawyer case might be an example. A lawyer will perhaps defend a rapist in court. Now, the lawyer will find the rapist's actions repugnant, but they will have a particular approach to dealing with evidence, which separates their own moral feelings from the profession they're involved in. And that detachment's crucial. Unfortunately, now in many disciplines, and it is creeping into history, there are some people who have a particular ideological tilt on things. And perhaps we all do, but they allow their work to be infused with that tilt. And they begin to develop patterns where they don't admit contrary evidence, or they dismiss it, or they undermine it, or whatever. And that's unfortunate. But I put it like this. It doesn't pass the sniff test, because when you read these works, even if you're an absolute supporter of that person's ideology, you can sniff that this is not serious history in the sense that it doesn't adhere to the rules of method. It's the sort of history that's really propaganda. Dressed up as history, has all the apparatus of it, the footnotes, the bibliography. It looks like it's well argued, but you can sniff that something's not quite right here. And I think that's a huge disservice to the discipline and to readers.
It won't surprise you that I agree. Look, I found it in political life, which is not as noble as that of a historian. But so many people, and maybe I was guilty of this too, you take a position, you take a moral position on something, and you just find the evidence to try and support your cause. You know, in the social media space, we're talking about narrow casting. You only look, think, and read about that which agrees. So, I mean, how do you... It's probably a personal question. As a historian, you'll have a view. How is it that you've processed quite substantial contrary evidence? Has there been moments where you've had that? You've had a perception, you've done your research, and you come across something quite liminal, changing. I mean, how have you faced that? I mean, you're a professional, of course, but what is that moment like?
Well, I did a short booklet, it was about 130 pages, looking at the state of te reo Māori at the moment, a bit about the history of how we got to where we are and what's the future for the language. And I wasn't prepared for the reaction of it. It was really hostile. In fact, even just a couple of weeks ago, someone emailed me expressing their outrage. This is 6 years ago it came out, I think. Because I pointed out the language is facing some really serious challenges, and a lot of the so-called solutions are ill-conceived and not working, and I based on a lot of international evidence. Now, one of the things I was accused of was being anti the language, which was silly, because I said, look, in a way I'm te reo's best friend, because what a good friend will do is tell you the truth about your situation. They won't just say, oh look, you're wonderful, it's fine, and this, they'll be honest with you. And this was an honest, in a sense, interaction with the state of the language now and what's going wrong with the efforts to revive it. But before I published it, I actually sent it around to a number of other academics, two or three, whose views I like, and I said, gave them the instruction. I said, read through this, it's not a long book. Destroy it. I want you to take it apart. I want you to find errors with it. I want you to find alternative views. So I did this myself, but I sort of went through a process of destruction testing where a number of us tried to attack it from any different angle possible. And so when it was finally released, in a sense, it was as close to bulletproof as you can get. And yes, there was a lot of criticism, but the criticism never amounted to much. And I was disappointed too that some of the vocal public critics of it, I said to them, look, I'm happy to debate this with you anywhere, anytime you want. Just give me 48 hours notice, I can be there, I will do it. The one catch is I want it done in public so people can see for themselves. And not one person who criticised it was prepared to stand up to it. And I thought that was disappointing. If you're going to make a criticism of something, you should back it with evidence. They couldn't. And that revealed a sort of another aspect of a lot of issues now, which is emotion trumps evidence.
Oh, it's something which frustrates me endlessly. I'm a great believer in debate and discussion. I hold really strong views across a whole range of topics. But one of the things I enjoy the most is actually debating them and having them challenged. But these days, as you say, you get, well, my terms here, you get shouted down, cancelled, all of this stuff. It's like,
how are we going to progress forward? And maybe that's an argument, not that we need more, but an argument for history. Again, we can look in the past and see what happens. When going back to our earlier discussion, when actually belief or tradition or a set of values is prioritized over discussion and seeking, if you will, a foundation for truth.
Absolutely. And again, going back just before the Reformation, when, and remember, the Reformation was led by Catholics. This is something that people forget. They see it as a Protestant-Catholic issue. Absolutely not. I mean, Martin Luther, I think, for the whole of his life, identified himself as a Catholic.
Yeah, as Augustinian monk.
But you see within the Catholic Church, people starting to question the theology of the time and the obvious errors in that theology. A lot of them paid for it with their lives. They were tortured and so on. And you've got to wonder what sort of organization has to punish people for alternative views. The simple way to destroy them is just to point out why their views are wrong. And look, if someone comes to me tomorrow and says, Paul, we've disproved everything you've written. Here's the evidence. All I can do is say, yes, you're right. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. I made an honest attempt, but this new evidence shows the alternative. Fair enough. But you don't suppress people, because if you do, that indicates that you're scared of those ideas. And that's an indication of the potency of the idea in the first place. And the one thing history shows about ideas is that if they are worthwhile and valid and have substance, they don't go away. They can mutate, they can be expressed in different ways, but they just keep burrowing away and burrowing away until you confront them. And all you ever do by suppression is just delay the inevitable. It's not a solution. And unfortunately, people who do suppress various views at the moment don't appreciate that. Their fragility is such, they think if we put enough pressure on individuals not to say things, then our view of the world will triumph. And you've already lost at that point. You just don't realize it.
Oh, completely agree. In fact, my observation is that you get increasing coercion, if not violence, to hold those positions against the other ideas. And you're quite correct, says me to the historian, that in the Reformation, Counter-Reformation, pre-Enlightenment, we put people in stocks, burned them alive, all sorts of things to try and stop ideas. And in today's world, without drawing the analogy too far, you're put in the stocks of public opinion and derided online, or find that your speaking slots are cancelled. But the ideas keep going.
That's absolutely right. And I think that if you are certain about things, or certain as you can be, it creates an obligation to do something about it. I got cancelled from a talk I was due to give, an innocuous talk on heritage buildings or something, I think. And literally the day before...
On heritage buildings?
Someone had, in this committee of this group that was organising it, decided that it was too much of a risk, and so they cancelled me that day, the day before, and they said, look, we've decided we're going to have another speaker, and that's okay. But it doesn't really change anything. It just says, we're going to try to, stop you or cancel you, whatever. That doesn't change the ideas. They're out there. They're doing their work. And the best way, as I say, to contend with an idea you don't like is just to point out why you don't like it and deconstruct it. If you can't, maybe you might want to consider that your own ideas aren't quite right.
Well, I certainly found in my previous career in life, get lots of emails from people, didn't matter if it's on economic issues, ethical issues, whatever, people would write and tell me that I'm what's the sort of words I can use on radio? But politely tell me I was an idiot, or impolitely. But I'd often write back and say, look, I'd really like to understand why you think I'm wrong. I could well be wrong. But basically, they'd never reply. If they did, it was more abuse. I shouldn't laugh. It was terrible at one level. So what do you make then of this right side of history? It's one of my little bugbears, I better declare that, but people who run around saying you've got to be on the right side of history, to me it's an arrogance, because we don't know how history is going to judge us. But your perspective as a historian?
Oh, it doesn't even make sense. I think if anyone says you've got to be on the right side of history, it's an appeal to nothing. Firstly, there aren't sides of history. It's far more nuanced than that. It's very intricately marbled. It's not this monochrome that you're either there or here. It's much more complex. Secondly, it implies there's a moral absolute that prevails, that you've got to be in the right group to be judged this way in the future. Thirdly, there's a presumption that we know how people in the future will judge us, and we don't, because we're pretty harsh on people in the past. We're very good at looking at the 19th century and saying, well, how could they act like that? How could they have those values? But one thing is absolutely certain, is that 150 years from now, people will be looking at us with exactly the same view. How on earth could people in 2024 hold the values that they do? It's absurd. It's embarrassing. And so the presumption that there's a right side of history flies against the fact that history and the moral attitudes of societies keep evolving anyway. So there is no absolute right side. The idea that it's binary, right and wrong, doesn't exist. It's also denial of diversity, that if you look at, you know, we live in Auckland, it's an incredibly diverse city, and it's so much the richer for that. The idea that you have to place people in the right or wrong category is just arrogance, and it's ignorance, and it doesn't achieve anything. What's the point? The only thing I think it's used for is so people can advance their view to say, this is another reason why you have to believe what I believe in, because if you don't, you'll be judged later on as being wrong. Well, that's an appalling way to make a case. You make a case because you've got the evidence, not because some future society is going to see you as being in the wrong place at the wrong time. You'll be in the ground by that point. So it's a silly argument.
Oh, it frustrates me no end. As I say, I'm not a fatalist, but it's like, well, actually, as you say, I'll be dead, so who particularly cares what they think of me? But it's just a rhetorical flourish, it seems, which shuts things down. But what I don't understand, and maybe you've got an insight, is how do those who use the statement so blind to that contradiction we just briefly touched on, which is they sit in judgment of history, the Victorian era, or whenever, and question all the beliefs. They don't sit historically in the time and go, well, why did they think that way? They judge them on today's values, yet don't seem to have the wherefore to go, the next generation, the generation after, are going to apply the same test to us. Do they really think, and I'm probably misquoting here, but Fukuyama, that history's ended with us? Right now, we're perfect. We know everything. What's driving that contradiction? How can they not see it?
I think you've hit the nail on the head with Fukuyama. I mean, it was a preposterous assertion in the late 80s, but he thought when the communist states in Eastern Europe were collapsing, he thought, well, there's going to be social democracy spread throughout the world. It's the end of history. And it was a bit more fine-tuned than that, but that was the essence of his argument. And of course, it's completely wrong. But there is this, what you could call an apex thinking, which is where we are now is the best of all possible moral worlds. And we've reached the point where we've dispensed with religious morality, we've dispensed with traditional morality. We can look back at previous societies, and the only thing we can do is judge them harshly because they haven't reached our stage of enlightenment. The Whig historians in the 19th century in Britain applied this to British history. They said that British history was the apex of all history, and it's a history of relentless progress. Then you hit World War I with the mass deaths on the fronts. And of course, then you get to the Second World War with the Holocaust, and you realize, well, we haven't got a lot to be proud about or wave our flags about, because this moral greatness comes with moral degradation of a sort that's almost unimaginable. But it's an arrogance to think that where we are now is the peak of moral rectitude. And there are very good reasons to argue against that, for all sorts of reasons. Firstly, that it's a form of moral relativism. Secondly, there's no greater moral authority for a lot of Western societies than the harm principle. So you can do whatever you want, provided it doesn't harm anyone else. And that seems to be the governing principle. And so previous societies had all these repressive moral rules, but now we're liberated from that. You can do whatever you want, be whoever you want, act however you want, provided you don't cause harm to others. And that seems to have settled as the way modern societies see themselves. So it is an end of history point in a way. The problem with the harm principles, there's a lot of problems. One of them is, what's wrong with harm? This is what Nietzsche pointed out. What's if I want to cause harm to someone because it brings me satisfaction, what's morally wrong with that? Your only appeal is to the harm principle itself, so it's not an authority. It's a statement. I mean, you can go back to John Stuart Mill and say, well, Mill's my authority for not causing harm to others. But I could appeal to Nietzsche and say, well, what's wrong with causing harm? I want to. And that's a conundrum. Then there's all sorts of other problems associated with it as well, because, and not to put too fine a point on it, but using that harm principle, is it okay? I mean, bestiality is the example that's sometimes used, that you could justify bestiality on the basis that it doesn't cause harm to anyone else, perhaps to the animal, but then that's countered by the fact that we kill and eat animals. So the harm principle isn't a good basis for a lot of areas of how we act, but more importantly, it doesn't have a greater moral authority than itself. So it can't by itself, necessarily, it can't prohibit harm. It's just an appeal to not do harm. But so what? If my moral code says I want to inflict harm on people, the harm principle doesn't prevent that. And so the idea that this is the best we've ever been, I think, is an illusion. And we're already seeing things fraying at the edges, and it may get much worse.
I completely agree. The harm principle does my head in. Not that I want to inflict harm, let's be really clear to listeners, but as you say, as a principle, it doesn't have much depth. And you've just illustrated how putting even the slightest pressure on it, it begins to buckle. But I suppose the wider question is, does every, if you will, generation or every, I don't know, civilization think it's at the apex? Did the British Empire think it had it all set? Did the Romans, the Carthaginians, if we want to go back thousands of years, does each, I'll just say epoch, that's too big. Is this just a constant repeat? Is this, again, why we need to study history, to realise that every generation thinks it's got it together, and yet we should see we're always on a path of learning?
There was a historian who, when he was 8 years old, watching Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, he later reflected on that, and he said that it felt like the British Empire would never come to an end. And there's that old saying that the sun never sets on the British Empire. And the late 19th century was really the high point of popular enthusiasm in Britain for its empire. It was almost a cult, and it had all its paraphernalia. It was people turned a blind eye to the destruction it had caused, and they relished all the advantages it had supposedly brought. One of the interesting things about apex points in civilizations or cultures is that they're at the very end of the life cycle of that. So if you look at the British Empire, it starts in a reasonably serious way in the 1500s. And you've got 350 years, say, of ascent. But it's only at the tail end, when the wheels are falling off, but people aren't quite aware of it yet, that they're still relishing the past accomplishments. And they've built up a mythology about how wonderful it is, and they've built up a mythology about themselves. You know, we belong to the great empire. Gladstone said, if you're a Briton who doesn't have an imperial spirit in you, you're the equivalent of a Briton who's blind or lame, that you're an anomaly. He said it's almost innate in Britons that you have this imperial spirit, because Britons are set apart as a race. It's preposterous to read that now, but this was the view in the second half of the 19th century. But it's the view that comes at the very end of that cycle of, in this case, say, empires or particular culture. And we just don't notice it. The point at which we're rejoicing most in the way we are now is often the most dangerous point, because we're too busy parting, as it were, not realizing that everything that we hold to be dear is already falling apart.
That's actually quite profound, returning to a word I used earlier. You've actually, that's given me a lot to think about on top of everything else, actually. Yeah, that moment of change when actually, or potentially decline, actually, is the moment you begin to see where your values, morals, ethics, and various systems underpinning society are actually being called in
to deep question. Well, that's really cool, Paul. You've almost stumped me thinking about that one. So really fascinating point, Paul, around apex as people perceive history, perhaps at that turning point, or rather they begin to perceive what they think is the great elements of themselves or society as it's actually turning. But I wonder in the wider sense, and I'm thinking of particularly our current generation that are very focused on the now, as we say, the right side of history. They think they've got it right. In some ways, they don't see a value of history or objective history. It's just something for them to interpret. Does that, you think, lead to a certain loneliness? They're not connected to the past. They don't see the past as having value beyond what suits them. Do you think there's some relationship here, psychologically or otherwise? I know you're a historian, but do you think part of the modern loneliness, anxiety, is linked to a lack of knowledge or understanding of history?
Well, look, you go to a restaurant, and one of the things you may see when the meal is served, traditionally people would eat that meal. Now, some people pull out their phones and take a photograph of it before they eat it. Why? We know why. Because they're going to put it on social media to say, this is the wonderful meal, it's so well presented, and so on. But here's an interesting thing about that process, is I don't think there are many people who will take that photo of their meal, then wait 7 or 8 months and then post it. They have to post it pretty much that day. Why is that? Because there's a sense of immediacy about living in the eternal present. What matters to me is what's happening right now. No one's interested in a meal you had 7 months ago, but people might be interested in a meal you're having right now. So there's this fixation with the eternal present, that only what's happening now. And then we start to live our lives, using the photo analogy, and it's a series of snapshots of right now. It's just what I'm doing now that matters, or what I'm about to do. That's all that matters. People even frame in their minds, I'm going out with the kids. Actually, we could get a good photo for social media. Yeah, it's about that sort of connection. So there's a validation in living in the eternal present, and that's quite dangerous. It's rather like, I think it's Chesterton, but probably others have said similar things, that if you stop believing in God, it's not that you believe in nothing anymore, you believe in everything. And you become, in a sense, have your faith directed across every possible thing, because there's a belief urge that people have, and if it's not directed at some point, it might be misdirected at others. But people, I think, have got caught up in this belief that what's happening now is what matters the most. What that does, it not only amputates you from history, which means all those lessons and all that sense of identity become impoverished, but it also anticipates you from projecting into the future. So perhaps you don't see the future in terms of something bigger than the next opportunity, the next hit, the next experience. The analogy with drug addicts, the analogy with people who watch a lot of TikTok, is very similar. There's sort of perhaps a dopamine effect or something that you have by the next hit, by the next hit. And living that way is not a fulfilling way to live your life. There's not that much substance in it.
Well, it's no surprise you've put it much more articulately than me, but I do worry at times of, yes, as you say, those people so in the present, they worry for the future, but no deep appreciation or learnings from the past. And speaking of the past, you put up on LinkedIn the other day, and it's a mouthful, temporal, moral, demutation? Good Lord, I think of myself as a lover. Yes. Demutation. A lover of the English language. I can't even say that word. I just thought it was a fascinating concept, and I think a great way to begin wrapping this discussion up. So what is temporal moral demutation?
Well, it's basically the idea that the further back something exists in our past, or the past generally, the less we apply a moral lens to it. The war between Russia and Ukraine at the moment, or the actions taking place with Israel dealing with Gaza and so on, these provoke quite strong moral reactions. We don't have the same moral reaction to the Napoleonic Wars or to wars that were fought thousands of years ago. Why is that? Well, you might answer, well, because it's beyond our lifetime and so on. But there seems to be a pattern that the further away we are from an event, the less we tend to see it in moral terms, the more we see it in apparently neutral or objective terms. So no one really looks at the Napoleonic Wars now and says, well, oh, I'm furious with how that turned out, and there's outrage over it. It's laughable that we might react that way. But here's the thing. People are going to look at events in Israel and Gaza now. They're going to look at events in Russia and Ukraine 200 years in the future, and similarly have very little moral engagement with it. And this is the crucial point, that our moral sort of tension eases the further back something is. And it happens to us individually. You know, if you're out, say, with your wife in the country one evening, it's raining, you're going to a party or something, you're all dressed up, you get a flat tire. You hop out of the car and change it, and you know, you get soaked and muddy and it's cold, and you bruise yourself, perhaps in your knuckles or something, whatever. You hop back in the car and you're not in the greatest of moods. You're actually quite angry at this. And your wife turns to you and she says, you know, Simon, you know, one day we'll look back at this and laugh. And that's not a good thing to say to you at that moment, because you're quite upset still. But she's absolutely right. And a couple of years later, she'll recall that and you'll both laugh. Now, the event hasn't changed. The feelings you had at that event haven't changed. But the way you look back on it has. And we ease the tension over time. And so that idea of temporal moral diminution is one that the further back something is, the less we invest moral energy into it. And so the event doesn't change, but our perception of it does over time. It applies to us personally and applies to history.
Yeah, I was really struck by it as I read what you had written, and I wondered, as much to myself as anyone, when I react, if you will, morally, emotionally to events today, to somewhat think about tempering them, understanding that actually that moral perspective will change over time. In other words, does appreciating history help me moderate how I act today? I just thought it was a fascinating concept. Hey, and last challenge, you mentioned Israel, Gaza. I'm not dragging you into that topic, but it reminded me of Jonathan Sacks, that I think remarkable chief rabbi, who spoke about the difference between history and memory. Now, he was particularly talking about the story of the Jewish people. And he recounts talking to Isaiah Berlin, who talked about, in this case, the Jewish people having a sense of history, the things that had happened to them. But Jonathan Sacks says, no, actually, it's about memory. It's us recounting the stories of what happened to him, to them. Do you see a difference between history and memory, or is it just semantics?
No, they definitely overlap, but there is an important difference, I think, in the sense that Jonathan Sacks was addressing it, that memory is repeated down generations. There's a transmission mechanism in some cultures that they take certain memories or certain aspects of their past and they transmit them as being absolutely central. They're axiomatic to who you are. And one of the arguments for that is that that contributes to the strength of the group through enhancing or fortifying their identity. So what makes you who you are? Well, these are the memories you need to know. And you can see this in cultures around the world. People in the Balkans, for example, discussions about events that took place in 1389 in southern Serbia still form the basis. They're at the epicenter of what's happening to that country today. And you might think, why on earth is that? Because the traditions about that have been passed down to say, this is the central identity marker of who we are. And those traditions typically involve things like sacrifice, ill treatment at the hands of others, pervading injustice, but the triumph of the group despite that. And it's a real sort of galvanizing effect when you have that sort of memory being transmitted through generations. And I think that's one of the reasons for it. It's not conventional formal history, because it doesn't treat evidence in certain ways, it doesn't embrace alternative views. And precisely because of that, when you get two cultures that have similar memory transmission mechanisms next to each other, and those are fundamentally opposed, the resolution is not in history. The resolution isn't in just evidence. It's almost like you're asking the cultures to deconstruct in order to resolve, and that's not going to happen, because the essence of identity and culture is held in those perceptions based on memory.
That's another profound, I'm sorry, that's the word of the day for me, profound, another profound insight. It's one of the reasons I love interviewing people. It's
fascinating in itself, but there's always elements, Paul, I take away that challenge me, and I've got at least three, if not four, that you've dropped clangers for me, so I'm going to be spending hours pondering this. So can I say a big thank you for joining us, talking and sharing your views and perspectives on history, on memory, and how we draw that together to help us in society today. And of course, for talking about your new book. So everyone, can I encourage you to, look up Paul's work, look up his latest book on Arns Westra, as you say, all good bookstores. And Paul, thank you so much for making, all this time to come and chat with us.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, welcome back, love, or as other people might know you, Rachel, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks. It's lovely to be here.
Well, I think it's always a good sign that after week one, we're sort of both invited back in some ways. So that is great. And I received some, just some lovely, we call it mailbag. So listeners send in information by text or email. And there was a couple that I wanted to share with you because, really it's about you. So Kathy has said, it's great having Simon as a host. His wife, phoning in, was so endearing. Regards and best wishes to you all. And then there was a lovely one also from Jane. Jane's from Auckland. She says, loved Simon's first show today. And this is the important part. It brought tears to my eyes when his wife Rachel came on at the end. So gorgeous to hear the love and mutual respect in that brief exchange. What a great model these two are, and a lovely way to get to know more about Simon. The National Party's loss is definitely the RCR listeners' gain. Thanks heaps. That's what I thought was quite sweet.
Oh, that's very kind. Very kind indeed.
Well, do I let them know? Of course, I cried at our wedding. I don't normally get emotional, but that, yeah.
And I didn't. I'm usually the emotional one.
Yeah, quite funny looking back. There was one other person who came through my other social media channels, was asking, because you remember I put out the challenge for Ask Us Anything. So they asked us something that, you know, we could share about ourselves, but being the host, I thought I'd just turn it on you. What's something that listeners won't know about you?
Well, we are very lucky. We live in suburbia, but we have a decent-sized yard, and we actually have chickens, three beautiful, healthy chickens.
It's always good to stress that they're healthy. But not just, actually, now that you've gone down that line, not just chickens.
We also have a beehive, and we have a worm farm. We try to dispose of all our food goods in a responsible waste, in a responsible way. So we have a food worm farm and a compost bin too.
We do. And bees, which have only stung us once. Well, me once.
And me once.
Yeah.
Once each. And fruit trees.
Oh, yeah. And that herbs. As well. Used to have a dog, but sadly, little Fleur died. Yeah. Well, what? Okay, then, why do we have chickens? Well, I know why we have chickens, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, I didn't grow up with chickens or anything like that, and I don't believe you did either. But in my science class, so I was mainly a actually, now I'm a general teacher, but I was a science and maths teacher. We did a program that allowed us to have chickens that hatched in class. So a lot of learning around the hatching of chickens, the kids actually got to see them hatch in class, fortunately during class time. We weighed them, we measured them, we plotted graphs, we designed hutches for them. We just, learned about life cycle, lots of learning. But of course, when you raise them for the few weeks, then you get attached to them. So I brought three home and some other teachers took some home too. So that's why we have chickens.
That's why we have chickens. And they start out, I have to say, they start out very cute. And then, they still are cute now, but if you don't know things about chickens, they poop everywhere. So obviously we let them run about and you basically can track where they've been all day by the amount of poop on our deck and across the property. But they've been great.
But although we have a very big or good sized yard and bank for them to rustle around in, they do tend to prefer the deck, which is exactly where we don't want them.
That's exactly right. And they're not laying at the moment. We better go and have some words with them.
Yeah.
Anyway, love, we better keep rolling, but lovely to have you on the show again. And look, the challenge is still there, guys. If you have questions for us or more importantly for Rachel, drop us a line through texting 2057, or you can email it inbox@realitycheck.radio. All right, love, you have a great rest of the day.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining me this morning. And what a morning. What a morning. Look, thanks again for all your wonderful feedback and challenging feedback, too, through Mailbag. I'm looking forward to next week. A big thanks to Nick of the Free Speech Union for coming in and chatting to us. Dr. Paul Moon, of course. I mean, look, I love history, and so it's always great to talk to Paul. I'm always delighted to have Rachel on, of course. Who thought we'd end up talking about chickens, of all things? And good to share with you, well, I think good to share with you a few thoughts around the budget. Obviously, by next week, all of us will have digested that a little bit further. So very much looking forward to next week as well, a whole series of new guests. In fact, as a little teaser for next week, I'm hoping to have a bit of a King's Birthday flavour. Of course, we've got King's Birthday weekend soon to start. So I'm going to see if I can inject a little, if you will, monarchical flavour into next week. And so I'm going to leave it there, leave you to the Friday afternoon. But as always, if you have any thoughts, feedback, challenges, or anything in between, email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio, text us at 2057. And in the meantime, you have a great day.
Celebrating Western values, our democracy, and our rights, and hearing perspectives from right here in New Zealand and overseas. We live in a big, well-connected world, so join Simon O'Connor as he talks to guests from home and abroad about the issues that really matter. Join us at 10 a.m. every Friday, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.